This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And also, if you're going to do grains, now's a good time to get those started. The biodynamic outlook, moon in Taurus, it's an earth sign, good time for root plants. And the sidereal people agree, as they often do, with the biodynamicists. Moon in Taurus, it's a good time for root vegetables. And especially if you're looking for hardiness in drought conditions. Interesting to note that the alternative forecast, which often the advice that it puts out, you can either sort of take it or leave it. But now with the climate collapse upon us, more so now than perhaps ever before, people are beginning to take look a little bit deeper into some of the what the biodynamic people, the sidereal people, all of these different types of farming have to teach us about agriculture and about growing our food under very, very difficult conditions. Take a look at Texas, heading into the third or fourth year now of severe drought. Moving right into today's news. We have this from out of Eugene. After cutting jobs and facing consumer fury over rate increases, the Eugene Water and Electric Board has now grapple with the obvious payback of if you are doing something wrong, then there's always that backslap. Two groups are trying to organize the utilities. 300 unrepresented employees in one of the groups has filed two unfair labor practice complaints against the Eugene Water and Electric Board management. It's unusual for the utility, which went for nearly 100 years without a union forming in its ranks. So far, they've been able to keep people from standing up for their rights. That seems to be cracking under a general public fury over the way that the EWEB carries out business. The unionization drive comes after EWEB laid off 38 employees last year. Of course, the idea always is to, they say, trim costs in response to declining revenues. It's probably going to cut another dozen more jobs. But here's the deal. When they talk about the need to cut costs and laying people off, what that is maintaining the same standards for management. That means if there's a danger that because of mismanagement, management is looking at loss of revenue. The people that pay, of course, are the workers. Finally, after 100 years, workers, 300 people may not seem like a lot, but today, in today's labor world, that's significant. Some of EWEB's 86,000 ratepayers are also feeling pinched because part of their fix to the financial problem is to raise their rates. Ratepayers have a stake in the outcome of the unionization efforts to the extent that it might increase costs or reduce, well, they say the quality of electric and water service. That's never been the case. Unionization's improved is across the board. History shows it usually improves service. One organizing effort, a group calling itself EWEB Professionals, has petitioned the Oregon Employment Relations Board for union certification. That group says that a third of its proposed 63-member bargaining unit wants to be represented. The proposed union would contain engineering and environmental professionals. A hearing on certification is to be scheduled before the end of the month. So, stirrings. This weekend saw a convocation of labor activists and more from Eugene. So maybe the tide is turning. Okay, here's another tide. And one might think this is one of those touchy-feely stories that considering what's going on in the world today, that we might just let slide. But in fact, we coexist with other forms of life. We sometimes forget that. And we have severely disrupted the invisible, intricate, and so complex that we have really no way. We have no logarithms. We have no algorithms whatsoever that explain nature to us. We like to think of it as something simple and beautiful and lovely. It's actually a very complex system. And animals have to cross roads. Animals have their own routes that existed long before roads were ever there. So motorists know that they're not alone on the rural and isolated stretches of the state's highway system. All kinds of creatures, deer, elk, cougars, bears, and more, and the tiny ones too, roam places otherwise relatively untouched, except for, of course, the highways. And in rural areas, people tend to belt down those highways at astronomical speeds. The highways themselves have seriously disrupted migration paths for all kinds of animals, every species you can think of. In Washington alone, there are roughly 3,000 collisions annually between vehicles and wildlife. The Department of Transportation, like similar agencies across the western U.S., throughout Cascadia, is looking at ways to keep the highways safe for both people and wildlife. But you know what? Once again, financial problems generated by management, by Wall Street, have put a bit of a ding in this effort. And it's in contrast, of course, to the last decade when efforts to build wildlife overpasses and underpasses grew in popularity after vehicle-wildlife collisions increased in the 1990s. There is one project, however. It's nearing completion about 10 miles north of Goldendale on U.S. Highway 97 in Washington State. It's along a stretch of road where the Transportation Department estimates there are 50 to 85 collisions a year. Similar projects allow deer and other wildlife to cross under the highway. We shouldn't have to be doing this, though. That's the bottom line. Is we should have long, long ago resolved the problem and found ways to coexist, because we wonder why things do feel so out of balance. Maybe it's because our roads and the roads of other species continue to collide in these ways. Coming up a little bit later on May 2nd at Portland State University, we'll have a lot more on this in the run-up to the discussion. There is going to be a panel to discuss coal exports in the Pacific Northwest. Again, many people feel that the public outcry may not be sufficient to stop this. The forces pushing it are enormous, and whatever voice that we are able to muster, it's certainly now the time to use it full force. And maybe it's something. It's also time for actions that are a little bit greater than voices. We're trying right now to get Jeff Patterson with the Bradley Manning Support Network on the line. There's been a bit of a news story breaking there. The military prosecutors are trying to have Bradley Manning convicted of violating the espionage. That's the 1917 Espionage Act, rarely used against Daniel Ellsberg. It's basically a blunt instrument that's used to only when the government wants to silence a whistleblower. The Espionage Act over his release of the secret government files to WikiLeaks. Manning, the military prosecutors now are going to face an additional burden. And I'll wait and let you finish cheering after that piece of information. Yes, military prosecutors are facing an additional burden at the court-martial under a ruling that came down last week by Judge Colonel Denise Lind. Lind ruled at a pretrial hearing that prosecutors must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Private Manning have reason to believe that the files could be used to harm the United States or to aid a foreign power. Now, that is going to be, that's the crux of the matter right there. That's almost impossible to prove, because actually no harm whatsoever has come as a result of the leaks. And in fact, a great deal of good has been the result. Prosecutors had contended that they should be required to prove only that he willfully disclosed defense-related files in order if they wanted to win a conviction under that Espionage Act. So that's a significant hurdle and very, very difficult to prove, as Lind says, beyond a shadow of a doubt. We're trying to get Jeff Patterson on the line right now, and we hope that he'll be able to join us. He's a frequent guest on Air Cascadia. Moving right along, the FBI refuses to provide information. There are nuances to this story. So before you say, oh, yeah, it's the FBI again, listen to this. The FBI refuses to provide information on a massive, and I mean enormous, biometric identification database that it can identify. Here's what it uses. The database is now using to identify non-criminal civilians, citizens. They're using iris scans. They're using DNA. They're using facial and voice recognition. And the list goes on. Virtually every part of your body, and even at this point, one has to wonder if one's own mind is safe from the probing. The Electronic Privacy Information Center, whom we have to thank for this, EPIC sued the FBI in federal court, claiming that the Bureau identified more than 7,000 pages of responsive records but won't release them. EPIC claims the FBI began posting details on its website about its biometric identification system, known as the Next Generation Identification, back in 2009. The database includes photographic images of millions of individuals, neither criminals nor suspects. It's the Department of Homeland Security spent hundreds of billions of dollars on this, and it wants to integrate it into state and local surveillance systems. There. So that's why you have to worry about domestic drones. Moving further along, we'll put the rest of today's news on the KBOO website, KBOO/AirCascadia. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, April 15th, 2013. Carlos Chavez engineered the show today. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, a university for grown-ups, where it's never too late to earn a bachelor's or master's degree to achieve your dreams. Adults of all ages choose Merrillhurst to gain knowledge from professors who practice what they teach. Now enrolling for fall term. Information at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In ancient civilizations, the energy of human slaves planted crops, clothed emperors, and built cities. Slavery was the cornerstone of more recent societies as well, like the pre-Civil War American South. Yet when the abolition movement in the United States finally triumphed at the end of the Civil War, it had an invisible ally, coal and oil. Fossil fuels dramatically replenished slavery's ranks with combustion engines and other labor-saving tools. Since then, oil has transformed culture, politics, economics, science, agriculture, and even our concept of happiness. This morning, we're going to talk about some very uncomfortable truths about our dependency on oil with Andrew Nikiforuk, author of a new book, The Energy of Slaves. He argues that we still behave like slaveholders in the way that we use energy, and that urgently needs to change. For more than two decades, Andrew has written about energy, economics, and the West. He's been on Locus Focus a couple times to talk about his previous books, The Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and The Future of the Continent, and Empire of the Beetle. Andrew, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.
Well, last time we talked was about bark beetles, which was a cheerful subject. And before that, we talked a bit about tar sands. And I'm just wondering if all the thinking and writing and speaking that you've done about the tar sands operations that are just a few hundred miles north of where you live in Alberta influenced your decision to look a little bit more broadly and deeply into our issues about our relationship to fossil fuels and the energy that they provide us.
Absolutely. I've been writing about the oil and gas industry here in Alberta for nearly 20 years. And if I hadn't been doing that, and if I hadn't been going up to Fort McMurray and looking at the huge mining operations taking place there, I don't think I would have written Energy of Slaves. I mean, when you live in a place that becomes so obsessed with hydrocarbons, that in fact really becomes a plantation economy, for mining oil or gas or bitumen, then you start to ask some questions. Okay, so what is this all about? And then you really have to ask some moral and philosophical questions about the demand for energy and how we use it. And that's what got me going on Energy of Slaves, for sure.
Well, I'm interested in this whole concept of energy slaves, or the energy of slaves. My partner was looking at this book and just kind of looked at it real briefly, and she thought it was a history of slavery and didn't understand until I started talking to her about it,